Hi, and welcome to Climate Critical. My name is Judith, I'm the host for this show, and this is the first podcast episode. This episode is a showcase for my master's graduation project for Design for Interaction at the Technical University in Delft, the Netherlands. Why this podcast? Well, we as humans emit way too much greenhouse gases for the Earth to balance out. And that's why the climate is changing. This is due to many different factors, but can in essence all be boiled down to energy use and agriculture. The amount of stuff and food we produce and consume is huge. It's simply not sustainable anymore. There are many things we need to change if we want to keep the climate livable for us humans. Through this podcast, I hope to teach you about the climate crisis, how it's a very complex problem, and hopefully make you more critical towards the plethora of greenwashing, good intentions, and make you able to filter out the actual sustainable actions. Each episode will discuss a different topic. After this introduction part, I have a discussion with an expert to look at the data and the science behind it and have them answer some questions. I end the episode with practical tips and conclusions that you can actually use in your everyday lives. We all need to eat. So even if you never cook, you're still dependent on cooking. Cooking accounts for about 3.7% of our global greenhouse gas emissions. And that's not even considering the impact of food itself, which contributed about 18.4% of global greenhouse gas emissions in 2016. So it's a good topic to dissect for this first episode. Cooking has a significant impact in terms of greenhouse emissions. But why? Do we cook too much? Just inefficient? Is it just a necessity we can't get around? Is induction cooking superior to electric or gas stoves? Or does the kind of food matter? Or the materials of the stove and pans? Well, the answers to this are different for different areas around the world. We'll be discussing a relatively wealthy Western European cooking perspective. All right, that's all for now. So let's dive into the second part and let's talk with an expert. Hi, Yvette. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. And well, let's jump right into it. First question, of course, what is your name and what pronouns do you use?
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me. My name is Yvette Zwieringa, and I'm a she, her.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. You're going to tell some things about cooking, about food, and about the impact on the climate. Well, thank you so much. And well, first question, what do you do and what is your area of expertise exactly?
Yes, I currently work as a sustainability advisor for Rijkswaterstaat. And this is the Dutch government agency responsible for developing and maintaining all the major infrastructure on water and land in the Netherlands. So you can think of bridges, roads, but also the dikes, the coastline maintenance, waterways, rivers, and also several areas of nature. And my role is, as a sustainability advisor, is to advise projects on how to integrate sustainability from the very start in the design. So whenever they're developing a new road or whether they are thinking of how to maintain a certain large bridge, for example, then I think of how they can do that sustainably. Very interesting. Before that, I've also worked in Brussels for a business network on sustainability and corporate social responsibility. So I've worked on both the government, but also the corporate side and NGOs side in the field of sustainability. More specifically regarding my expertise, I have a master's degree in sustainability science and policy from Maastricht University. And I have in total 8 years of working experience in the field.
It's very nice. Thank you. What exactly do you mean if you say, well, my job is to do any task sustainably? What does sustainability mean for you?
That's a good question. Sustainability for me is, very simply put, it's about how you do something in a way that you have as little negative impact on the world and as big as a positive impact as you can get. And that goes from, you know, a lot of things, from how you produce something, how much materials you use, but it's also about how you work with your people, how you, you know, do people have fair working living, or how do you say that, circumstances in which they work. So it's all these things together that make up sustainability. And in the end, of course, we want to prevent climate change or adapt to it as good as we can. And yeah, sustainability is doing things in a way that you don't have negative impact on that.
Cool, thank you. Well, the second question I had prepared is, well, what is the impact of cooking on the climate?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And I really like cooking myself as one of my my hobbies. But in fact, cooking and eating is responsible for quite a big chunk of our emissions. It's in fact around 21% of our carbon footprint of every household. So that is, you know, 1/5 of all our emissions from our households comes from cooking and eating, which is a lot. And that might actually surprise you, but that is more than that of the use of our cars and public transportations, and it's more than the heating of our houses. So this is really a large impact on the climate. And as such, we also have a lot to win if we improve our ways of eating and cooking.
Which part is responsible for the most greenhouse gas emissions and, well, this impact on the climate exactly?
Yeah, as I mentioned, when talking about sustainability, it's important to look at the whole picture. With regards to food and cooking, we are looking at various aspects from how food is produced, and then you look at the amount of water, the amount of land or energy and fertilizers that are needed to produce and grow crops. Then you have the transportation of all this food. So how does it go from wherever it is produced to your plate? Then there is the energy that is needed that you use to cook the food itself, but also materials and energy that are needed for packaging and processing of food. So all of these elements have an impact, and it really depends on the type of food that you eat or the type of food that you use, how big this impact is. So it's hard to say this aspect is the biggest, because it really depends per type of food that you use and where you are based, of course, and where the food comes from. But overall, we can say that from the entire food industry, if you look at the statistics, then the cattle and livestock and fisheries make up the biggest part of the greenhouse gas emissions as a whole. So that means that the production of meat and fish is really the most energy intense, if you will. And then the transport and the food processing, etc., they also have an impact, but relatively small compared to the amount of materials and resources needed to grow crops and animals.
So if we would focus on 1, 2, maybe 3 things that have the most greenhouse gas emissions related to cooking and our eating habits, which are the top 3 most important things to remove or do better?
Yeah, the biggest thing that you can improve is their meat consumption. And you can generally say the bigger the animal, the bigger the impact. So, you know, if you eat a cow, it has more impact than eating pork. And chicken has less impact than pork. So, you know, there's a hierarchy. And it is very simple, because the bigger the animal, the more food and space and time it needs to grow compared to a smaller animal. So with that in mind, meat in general is the biggest production, the biggest thing. The second is actually the dairy products. So also butter, for example, milk, even eggs, they also have a relatively high greenhouse gas emissions, or a footprint, if you will. And the third thing that we can do in order to improve our habits and to reduce our impact on the climate is perhaps not wasting food, because we in fact waste about 1/3 of all food that we produce worldwide. So that's, you know, 1/3 just goes right into the bin. And you can imagine how much energy, how much water and land and resources are needed to grow old pieces of food. So if you throw it away, you really waste it. So by not wasting it, by cooking smarter, buying smarter so that you don't buy too much, or storing it in your freezer, keeping it, you know, being clever with, you know, just reusing leftovers, etc., in a new dish. There's a lot of ways that you can improve your waste, and that has a big impact also.
I have one question about the one you said about distance and water usage. Because is there a way for me to know if, for me, if I'm in the supermarket and I'm like, okay, I want to buy a tomato, and there's one from the Netherlands, one from Spain, one from Colombia. Like, how do I know which is better? Because I've also heard that in the Netherlands, it probably needs a greenhouse, and in Spain, it might just grow on solar energy, you know, just being in the sun. So how is there some way for me to know in the supermarket which is, yeah, what's actually irrelevant? Is further away always better? Are there certain countries that I should avoid, or is there another rule I can follow?
Well, that is a challenging one, because like anything, it's always a trade-off. You know, if you buy your product locally from the Netherlands, you might have your tomato, then you might need more energy to produce that tomato than when it comes from Spain. But of course, when it comes from Spain, you need to have the transportation costs and energy that are needed for that. So that makes it difficult, and that means that there is not really one perfect answer for this question. But what you can do as a consumer is to look, you know, first of all, it's to be aware that these are considerations that you should have. Like, oh, hey, my product comes from Spain, it has traveled here all the way from Spain, is that the smart one to go for? Or all the way from Colombia, which is even further away, of course.
Okay, so the conclusion is it's complicated.
Yeah.
And there's no easy way for me as a consumer to know which is better for certain.
No, it's not so easy. But if you want to have some small rules that are simple and easy, shorter distance is probably better. If it's in season, it's probably better than when it's not in season. If it comes, you know, if it has a very complicated list of ingredients, then it's probably less good than simple ingredients, also for your health. And, you know, so, and of course, if it comes from regions, you know, where you know, oh, there's a lot of drought or problems, then it might be less good than when it's produced in a country that is better off. And if it has a certificate, it's probably at least in some ways better than those without.
I want to throw it on. We've discussed food a lot, but I also wanted to discuss cooking. So I have an A or B question. Which is better, induction or gas stoves?
Yeah, once again, I will have to say there is no easy answer. whether you use gas or induction, and whether that's better or worse, it depends. It depends on the type of gas or energy that you use, for example. If you use green gas, or if you can use green energy for your induction, that is better than when you use gray gas or fossil or like fossil fuels. Also, it depends on how you cook and how you prepare your food. If you use a lot of pans at the same time, if you use a lot of energy, you know, if you want to heat up your entire stove or oven or whatever for just, you know, frying up one egg, and then it has to heat up and it cools down, and you actually waste all of that energy just for one single, you know, egg that you wanted to fry up. Not saying that you should never do that, but it's just to consider that how you use it. So it's always better to, if you use, cook more efficiently. So if you buy, or if you, losing my words here.
That's okay.
If you cook for multiple people or for multiple days at a time, that is more efficient than cooking a little bit every day, for example. Also, there are a lot of ways, you know, there's a lot of like some techniques that you can say, well, you boil, for example, you boil an egg, you bring it to the boil, and then you turn off the heat, but let it leave your pots on the water or on the heat, and then it will continue the boiling process, basically, rather than having your water on the entire time. So then the cooking time is a bit longer, but your use of energy is much shorter. And this can be done regardless of induction or gas stoves. So that is something that you can consider.
Next question ties in nicely to what you already started on. What are some of the best habits we can teach ourselves to improve our efficient cooking?
I think one of the ways to do that is, first of all, think about what you cook. We've already talked about this a lot, so I won't repeat it all over again, but think about the products that you use and the impact that they have on the environment. The second habit is to cook efficiently. So maybe prepare more meals at once, and you can then store them for the use over the next days, or maybe make some bigger portions so you can use it for lunch, bring it to the office, maybe share it with your neighbors if you have a lot of food, but do something to make sure that you eat the right amount of food. And you'd also, this also helps for wasting food, because that's another thing that we want to avoid as much as possible. So don't waste food. There are a lot of things you can freeze. Actually, there's a lot of fruit things that you can, there's a lot of headache you can also freeze if you see, oh, my fruit is almost going bad. You can freeze it, you can chop it up and then freeze it, and then you can unfreeze it whenever you want to use it. And that's perfect, especially if you want to make smoothies of it, for example. So those are like small things that you can do to avoid waste. There's also things like apps that can help you. There's this one app called Too Good To Go where you can help rescue a meal from your local restaurant or supermarket where, you know, wherever products are almost expired, then you can buy them for less of the price, for a smaller price. So it's good for you, good for the environment, and you learn to do something new, or you can be creative with cooking. And I think that's in general like a good exercise, to be creative, to try cooking with whatever you have at home. And also, if you really want to do it well, you can of course produce your own food. If you have a garden or a house or a balcony, you know, there's always little things you can do. Herbs, you can do vegetables in your garden, and by doing that you also learn and you become more aware of how much it actually takes to grow, you know, something. You know, I don't know if you've ever tried, but I've tried raising my herbs, and they tend to die at some point. And yep, you know, I have strawberries in my garden, but it's very complicated to get some, you know, amount of strawberries that you usually buy in the supermarket. So I think doing these things, you know, besides having your own food, you know, right from where, you knowing what goes into it, but it's also fun to, as a fun way to be more aware of what it takes and to appreciate more the food that we buy and eat.
I like that. My critical brain already started thinking, well, how do I know if throwing away a little bit of waste is better than using energy to store it, actually, because a freezer also needs energy. So is that a better choice?
Storing it is better than throwing it away, yes, for sure, because it, think about all the energy that has been used to produce this food. So, you know, you have the land use, the water use, the transport, the packaging, you know, there's a whole chain of production that's before, you know, before the food was on your plate. So if you then throw that food away, you also throw away all that previous energy and resources that has gone into it. And in that sense, it's definitely more viable to store it in your freezer or in your fridge and using that little energy to preserve it. But of course, yes, it's even better if you manage to plan your meals in such a way that you use it the next day so you don't have to store it in the freezer at all, for example.
Thank you. Then we have the last question. How much of this, all of the things we discussed, what exactly is the responsibility of the consumer and which parts are the responsibility of governments and or companies?
Yeah, I find this a very interesting question. And I've thought about it many times during my studies and also in all my years of work experience, how much can we ask of consumers versus companies and governments? In my opinion, all of them have a part to play. So it's not just one party that is responsible. The consumers have a responsibility to be aware of what they buy and to be aware of what they use and how it's produced. So I think there's some kind of responsibility to get informed at least and to use that information and that power and their power, let's say, to make choices. So depending on what you buy, you make a choice every day whether you're going for a somewhat more sustainable product or not, and whether you buy, you know, a piece of meat or vegetables or a vegetarian burger, you make a choice, and that choice depends, you know, that has an effect. You know, it might seem small, but it has an effect, especially if many people start doing it. And that's what you see happening. So that's where the companies come in. So the companies are basically ruled by supply and demand. So if everybody is demanding vegetarian, then they will produce vegetarian. It's very simple. But of course, I believe it is very much so the responsibility of companies, and they are probably, in my opinion, the biggest players in all of this, because they have the power and the means to change the way that they produce their food. So if they know that they have a certain supply chain, if they are aware that they are producing negative impacts, then they are responsible to tackle that. And this is called actually internalizing externalities, expensive words, but it means that we have a lot of negative impacts. Let's say if I produce, or if I'm a company that, you know, supplies or that brings the bananas from, I don't know, somewhere back to the Netherlands, then this company is, or that has the whole supply chain, for example. It's a simple chain. You grow the banana, you transport it. There's maybe some packaging and storing, and then it goes into the supermarket and into your house. But the companies that manage this, they have a negative impact, for example, on the local communities because they have demands on the price, and they're such a big player that they can downsize the prices, so the people get, you know, they stay poor, they don't have means for a good life. But this is the price that, you know, this effect, the company doesn't pay for that, or the company that's not seen in the price. Same as the greenhouse gas emissions that, you know, cause climate change, those are usually not part of the price because they are external costs, let's say. They're side effects. The same as, you know, you also have positive side effects. If you have a cookie factory that produces the smell of freshly baked cookies, that would be, you know, maybe a positive externality. But you have to internalize these costs, these external costs, to really get to the true pricing. And I think this is where companies really have a role to play, that they need to pay for the damage they do, basically, the polluter pays principles. So I think that is very important that companies do something about it. Also, because consumers can never do everything on their own. You know, as long as food comes in plastic packaging, the consumer can want to reduce their plastic use, but it will never happen if everything is, you know, continuously plastic wrapped. So I think the companies have a big role to play there. And then thirdly, we have the governments. I believe that the governments also have a very important role in setting the rules for the companies. So the government has to say, this is the, you know, this is the regulation, this is where you need to operate, this is the how much you can, for example, how much waste you can produce. You can, they need to set the caps, they need to set the regulatory policies in order to make sure that the companies are kind of forced to start thinking about their production in another way, and that they are not, you know, because right now it's very easy for companies to say, oh, I have to, you know, do everything as cheap as possible, because that way, you know, I'm as efficient as possible. But by going too far in that, and if there's nobody checking them, then, you know, they can do whatever they want. They can use all the, have all those external costs and not pay for them. So I think that's important, that the government sets, you know, challenging regulations, but also stimulates innovation and stimulates, you know, changing and creates opportunities for companies that want to do different, because they are there. So I think that's the interplay of the government versus consumer and companies.
Do you have anything else you want to add? One conclusion or one additional thing you'd like to mention?
Well, I know it might be difficult to grasp, you know, all of the choices that you have to make or to consider. But I want to say, don't forget to also have fun with cooking. And it is in your power to be creative and to make changes, and even small changes, you know, eating vegetarian a bit more often than you used to, maybe thinking about the product that you do, or do small steps one at a time, and together we can make a big difference. But, you know, most of all, don't feel overwhelmed, and small steps, keep the fun, and make it a challenge, you know, make it a challenge to do better.
Thank you. I love that. Thank you so much. That was a lovely interview. I actually learned a lot. But I know from experience, it's hard to filter and remember the most important things after listening to such a long interview. So I'll summarize the key points here for clarity. We've established that the biggest impact is in what you eat, not in the cooking or any of the other aspects. The single best thing you can do for the environment is to eat less meat. And if you want to eat meat, go for the smaller animal. Rule of thumb, the smaller the animal, the better for the environment. The next best things to do is to eat less dairy and create less food waste. When you're in the supermarket, be aware of what you buy and really think about it. You'll probably not know for sure which is the best choice, but the first step is to be aware of the trade-offs. In general, products that are in season, are locally grown, and are not processed are the best foods to buy. For cooking, we really need green energy production. If our energy grid is fully sustainable, induction cooking will be by far the better option over gas cooking. And also be creative in how you cook. Plan ahead, use leftovers, freeze your food before it goes bad, and be more efficient in your energy use. We also discussed the roles of different players. Companies actually have the means and money to change the systems for the better. Government should have a guiding role here. Support good production, set rules to prevent bad production. We as consumers can use the power of choice to change the demand, which again can stimulate the companies to change for the better. And you can use your power to vote for leadership that will make those sustainable rules for companies. So, think about what you eat. Eat less meat, less dairy, and create less food waste. Be creative in how you cook, and use the power of your choices. And don't forget to have fun. That was all for this episode. I hope you learned something new and have a better understanding of what you can do. Links to all the sources can be found in the description. And if you have any feedback, tips, or requests, let me know via the link in the description. Thank you for listening to this episode of Climate Critical.